the Mountain Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. Last week, Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency in California in connection with the coronavirus outbreak. Today, the president made it a national state of emergency. Now that both D.C. and Sacramento are on the same page, we'll hear what it could mean for every Californian. Plus, if you've decided to stay home all weekend, we've got a list of fun stuff to do to try to avoid cabin fever. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Friday. It's raining. A lot going on. We're going to start right off the bat with State of Affairs. Take a look at the political response we're seeing to coronavirus. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Marisa Lagos is political correspondent at KQED. Thanks, both of you, for coming on. So let's jump right on in. About a half hour and a half ago, President Trump finally declared a national emergency. Let's hear a clip from that.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency. Two very big words. The action I am taking will open up access to up to $50 billion of, very important and a large amount of money for states and territories and localities in our shared fight against this disease.
All right, Marisa Lagos, so start us off by just telling us what this means for the flow of necessary provisions.
Yeah, so this is an act that's often invoked during natural disasters, say something like Hurricane Katrina. But there is the ability to do this in the case of a disease outbreak. And it essentially clears the way for states to ask for up to 75% of reimbursement for their responses to this type of coronavirus outbreak. As the president said, we're talking about as much as $50 billion in aid at this point. And some other things around, I think, you know, the healthcare system that we're starting to get some more clarity around.
And Marisa, for those who missed it, what else did the president unveil today?
Well, I know we're going to talk about this later, but importantly, part of that declaration is allowing states to sort of more vastly expand their Medicaid rolls, so to get people onto insurance that's helped paid for by the federal government. And he also gave this broad new authority to the health secretary, Alex Azar. It's going to let HHS waive regulations, give doctors and hospitals more flexibility, make it easier to treat people remotely. So really trying to sort of cut through some of the red tape that we're hearing about around the nation in terms of the ability for the healthcare system and for governments to respond to this.
And Zach Corser, using history as a guide for a second, what are some of the traits that the best leaders have shown in times of uncertainty, just like the one we're going through right now? And what have we seen so far from this administration?
Well, in the past, if you think about major events in American history, like World War II, the Great Depression, oftentimes when people think of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they think most about his ability to communicate, his ability to reach Americans and to reassure them. We think of the fireside chats that Roosevelt helped to innovate as using broadcasting to speak directly to the American people. You know, all leaders have to face limited resources in terms of information, particularly when things are emerging and we don't really know the direction that we're going in yet. But leaders have to reassure, they have to explain, and they have to communicate. And I think that's been the biggest gap with the Trump administration and the American people, is there's been a lot of contradictory information. There's been a constantly changing agenda from whether or not this was a kind of media hoax or whether this was actually a serious pandemic that required something like an emergency declaration. And I think we've seen over the last weeks, months, really, since January, a slow but unstoppable movement towards the fact that this couldn't be, you know, Trump administration could not just turn this back with talking points. It was just too much was going on. There's too much evidence, too many facts, and too many people around the country. Whether it's colleges and universities, states, governors, basically, you know, getting ahead of the federal government and responding on their own. So I think it's just sort of this lack of clarity and certainty. And I think the address on Wednesday was particularly confusing and troubling. Markets reacted very negatively. And it was sort of fascinating to watch just in the closing hours of the market today that it went up almost 10%, simply because I think the Trump administration, led by the president, finally admitted that, yes, this is a national disaster.
And Marisa, going to that address from earlier in the week, the response to it seemed, again, just like our times, partisan. someone that was maybe a Democrat really just criticized it. And Republicans, although I will say this, Republicans for the most part said it was okay, but not maybe ideal. So what have you seen when it comes to a response from this administration?
You know, I have to say, I've been really appalled, and I don't usually use the strong of language as a reporter, but watching on Wednesday night when the president seemed unsure of himself, misspoke even though he was reading from a teleprompter, and then just the series of news conferences where Mike Pence, our vice president, and various members of the administration seem more concerned about sort of pepping up the president and giving him accolades for things that we all know are not happening in the way that they need to and with the speed that they need to. It's been really appalling, and I think that this should not be a partisan issue. You know, this disease obviously does not care. This virus does not care if people are Republican, Democrat, Independent. And so I do think that the president seems to be viewing this through a prism of the economic disaster that it could cause. He does not seem to fully grasp the health aspect of this. I mean, at the news conference today, we saw him shaking hands with all of these CEOs and, you know, and saying he's not going to get tested because he's asymptomatic, even though we know he's been exposed to people. And he's saying that people can be asymptomatic and still have this virus. So it's been pretty just jarring to watch.
All right, Zach, now to California. Governor Gavin Newsom ramped up the state's response to the virus. He signed an executive order on Thursday. What is he asking for?
Well, he's asked to make an extension for people filing California tax returns if the virus had affected them. He's eliminated a week waiting period to receive unemployment benefits. But I think the biggest move was essentially canceling events of 250 people or more in the state, at least until the end of the month. And it looks like perhaps through April. And this, you know, it's a pretty major move. And it's been mirrored in things we've seen from the NBA and I guess Major League Baseball is now taking a move to move back their opening day. He also went to say that the state could potentially seize hotels and medical facilities to use for quarantine if necessary, which is, you know, it's a major move. But it's also sort of reassuring, I think, that, you know, capacity has been a big issue, a public policy issue in all of this. We've talked about the sort of steep curve versus the low curve that, you know, we're not really going to perhaps stop this virus entirely, but we can slow it down and we can basically use our resources, our medical resources, not tax them if we're able to slow the spread. And so I think moves like thinking ahead about capacity issues, I think it's reassuring. And I think it's a smart move to say to the state that, you know, if we need it, we have these extra facilities.
Yeah, Marisa, when Gavin Newsom declared that any big event should not happen, the sports leagues that are in California hadn't yet decided what they decided a few days ago, which is to pretty much suspend, postpone, or cancel some things. So when he said that, I thought, okay, how's that going to work? There are, let's see, 3 NBA teams in California. There are 5 Major League Baseball teams in California. Could it be possible that some of these leagues decided to take cues from what's going on in these states?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. And I think with Newsom, what we're seeing is a real sort of move to rely on the relationships that he has built with some of these people. We know that he talked to the CEO of Disney directly, right? But right before Disneyland said that they were going to close down this weekend. And so what he's basically said is, I could force all of this. I don't want to unless I need to. And so far, what we've seen is really the private sector, I would argue, stepping up ahead in some cases of our federal government to take the responsibility here. So I think that if they need to, I think that the state is absolutely poised to force the shutdown of large gatherings and things like that. But they've been trying to sort of work with people because it does seem like Californians are really willing to take a lot of these precautions without being saying, you know, without like the threat of criminal prosecution hanging over their heads.
And up until the president did declare that national emergency a couple of hours ago, California and other states kind of had their hands tied when it comes to Medicaid and using it to help treat people. Marisa, who would have been affected had Trump not decided to declare the emergency?
Really the most vulnerable in California. So people who are low income, who have not already signed up for our healthcare system. This is something that we've seen done on a bipartisan basis across administrations and other emergencies. And it's really going to let the state sort of waive some of the requirements, speed up enrollment, and hopefully get more people tested.
You know, I was writing down some of what the president was saying in the press conference, writing, you know, notes to myself as quickly as possible. And I got to admit, I lifted an eyebrow when he mentioned about lifting the Medicare Industries lifted regulations so that Americans can receive the health care they are entitled to. It's been a political talking point, right? Hasn't it, Marisa, when it comes to health care and who should be able to get it?
Yeah, and I think that that's likely one of the reasons we saw the Trump administration sort of slow walking this is that we know that the head of their agency that oversees Medicaid has been very supportive of efforts to cut the program in other states. And so I think that this is part of the problem. This is probably a big part of the sticking point between what Democrats are proposing in the House around a relief package and what the Trump administration and Republicans in the Senate are willing to go for, which is Democrats are pushing broader long-term changes to things like unemployment and sick leave. And Republicans, I think, are loath to give them that win in this moment. And they just, on a sort of philosophical level, oppose a lot of those programs. I think what's going to be interesting to watch is whether that changes, given the political pressure on them to really do something to tackle this.
Zach, on that emergency declaration, you think President Trump was worried about how it would affect the presidential race?
Oh, absolutely. This has been a real challenge for the Trump administration to deal with this crisis. And I think they've been flat-footed. I think a lot of the same kinds of maneuvers that Trump has used to great success in terms of the way he can dismiss ideas he doesn't like or finds inconvenient as fake news, the way he can politicize any issue and try to control the narrative through the media and in politics. All of these tools are just not working with the coronavirus. And I think he's been really shocked and a little bit unawares about what to do about it. And I think there's also a dawning reality. We've almost lost the narrative of what was happening with Super Tuesday. And then this last Tuesday with Michigan and the sweep of Joe Biden. Joe Biden is an incredibly strong candidate now. He's absolutely the front runner. I think it's just a matter of time before Bernie Sanders steps aside. And we're going to have a full focus on Joe Biden as a candidate. So I think that is another thing that's sort of pressuring Trump is like the weaker he looks in response to this, I think also the weaker he looks in relation to Joe Biden going into November. So absolutely, I think the markets are chief on his mind and the election are chief on his mind right now.
Well, let's hear from Biden because he took an opportunity to criticize President Trump yesterday.
The coronavirus does not have a political affiliation. It will infect Republicans, independents, and Democrats alike. And will not discriminate based on national origin, race, gender, or zip code. It will touch people in positions of power as well as the most vulnerable in our society. And it will not stop. Banning all travel from Europe or any other part of the world may slow it, but as we've seen, it will not stop it. And travel restrictions based on favoritism and politics rather than risk will be counterproductive.
And the big part of any race, Marisa, a presidential race, is who sounds and looks and appears presidential. So how has that been received so far?
You know, I have to say, the press conference was good. I thought that Joe Biden's speech in Pennsylvania, you know, at the Liberty Hall on Tuesday night really set a tone that I think he was hoping for. It was somber. It was presidential. It was appropriate. And I think that you're going to see more of that, you know, this attempt to sort of rise above the politics as much as you can while you're in the middle of a primary still. I think it'll be interesting to see the tone that they set on Sunday, both him and Senator Sanders.
And Zach, listening to those remarks, it's almost as if Biden is attempting to maybe get those who are disappointed with President Trump's response behind him as quickly as possible, kind of like an alternative president. This was what it could be if I were president kind of deal. Do you get that sense as well from Joe Biden?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's in the sense of like there's two popes and he's trying to undermine Trump's authority. But I definitely think in the sort of shadow cabinet sense of, you know, showing what presidential leadership can look like under Biden, giving strong alternatives to what could be done right now in this situation, striking a contrast to the sort of, you know, temporizing and wavering Trump, who doesn't seem to be in command of the situation, towards a sort of confident message about what we should do about the coronavirus. I think it's been fairly successful, and I think it's going to continue to be so, particularly if Trump continues to put on these sort of, you know, strange press conferences and continue to sort of give mixed messages. It's going to make Trump look incredibly weak if Biden has sort of stays on message and shows that confidence.
And Zach, really quick, one last thing. I know some primaries are being affected by coronavirus. Is there anything in history about maybe postponing a presidential election if coronavirus is still an issue a few months from now?
I absolutely not. I mean, I think it stands to America's great credit that, for instance, in the depths of the Civil War in 1864, we held a presidential election and Abraham Lincoln was reelected. If we want to make an analogy to what's happening now, in 1918, the absolute height of the crisis where the most deaths were occurring were October and November of 1918, mm-hmm. and the elections still went on. So the, you know, there are some states, Louisiana has moved their primary forward, Wyoming has decided not to hold an in-person caucus. There may be some moves down the calendar, but places like Florida, Ohio, Illinois, who have their election upcoming, they said, we are absolutely putting out a joint statement. We're going to hold these elections. And I think we absolutely cannot talk about moving an election in November. I just think that's just un-American.
Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Marisa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Zach and Marisa, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, here at KPCC, we are, of course, committed to bringing you fact-based, reliable information about coronavirus. So we suspended our member drive that started on Wednesday, but we still need your support. We've been counting on the spring drive to fund the news that you're relying on about coronavirus. So please, please give right now at kpcc.org. And when you do, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by Gordon and Donna Crawford. That's kpcc.org, kpcc.org, and thanks. All right, back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Yeah, it's been quite a week. Here's a recap on everything that's happened just in the past 48 hours. The NBA and the NHL have suspended their seasons indefinitely, while Major League Baseball has postponed the start of its season for at least 2 weeks. Disneyland will close its theme parks for the rest of the month here in California starting tomorrow. And this morning, LAUSD and a number of smaller districts decided to close down schools. Not to mention there was that national declaration of emergency that happened just about 2 hours ago. So when it comes to news about novel coronavirus, information has been changing and fast. It can be hard to keep up, but we have some help on the line. Dr. Robert Kim Farley is with UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. He's also a former Centers for Disease Control and World Health Organization staffer. He's here with us now to help answer your burning questions and separate fact from fiction. Doctor, welcome back to Take Two.
Greetings, A. It's good to be back on your program again.
Now, understandable that people might be a little worried, maybe even scared right now. There's a lot happening, but maybe some context will help calm people down a little bit. One listener, Victor, wrote in and asked this: why is the world going off the deep end of hysteria for this pandemic? We've had many pandemics before here in the last 10 years. So how is this both similar and different for pandemics we've experienced in the past?
Yes, I think it's important to realize that there is an element of fear whenever you have some new unknown disease. We have had this in the past. We had, for example, SARS, but within 9 months, that genie, if you will, was put back into the bottle, did not go into a global pandemic. You have Zika. We've had others like this. But I think what's happening here is that, again, the rapid spread that's occurred around the world, the concerns being raised to see where, for example, in Hubei province in China, the health systems were overwhelmed. I think this is some of the reason why there has been some fear and concern. And I think it's important, though, that we recognize that we do need to interject some calm here. We do know about coronaviruses. We know what things we can do, both at the personal level, with what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions, or NPI for short, like covering the cough, washing hands. And we know what we can do at the community level when we are experiencing community transmission, as we're seeing now, where people are encouraged to telework from work, schools going to long-distance learning, internet-based. These sorts of things we know will ultimately blunt this epidemic, now becoming a pandemic.
And you mentioned how coronavirus, we've known about coronavirus, but is what's going on right now maybe a new member of that family or a newer member?
Yes, exactly right. This is different than the SARS or the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, which still is smoldering in the Middle East, if you will. This one shows a potential for much more contagiousness, that was being able to spread to other people. Fortunately, the case fatality rate is significantly lower than the other ones we've had experience with. For example, MERS was like 34.5% case fatality rate. SARS was about 9.4% case fatality rate. We're talking in the neighborhood probably of 2% here globally, but to recognize also that the case fatality is made up of two numbers, the number of deaths that you have reported and the number of cases that have been reported. The deaths were probably closer to, in terms of the correct number, the number of cases. There's so many mild cases that are not reaching to healthcare systems. They wouldn't need to reach to healthcare systems. They're not being tested, therefore not being diagnosed as being cases. And so that number actually is probably much larger. And if you look at another number that we often don't hear about much, but is not case fatality ratio, but the infection to mortality ratio. And in this case, the number you look at is how many people may be infected. No, it's totally asymptomatic, no symptoms. And if you look at that number, I'm sure that the death to infection ratio is order a magnitude lower than what we see to the case fatality rate.
Now, the last time we addressed this on the show, we talked a lot about at-risk groups, people who are more susceptible to the virus. On the flip side of that, one listener asked, quote, what is the likelihood of recovering from symptoms if you are not in an at-risk group?
Yes. So for those who are young and those who have no pre-existing medical conditions, the outlook is very bright. The real fatality rate, some 80% are those over 60 years of age. Some 75% are those that have pre-existing, you know, serious conditions like heart disease, prior lung disease like COPD, that sort of thing. So I think the important thing, though, is for your listenership to recognize that even if you're a younger person and you're saying, well, you know, it's not such a big deal for me, I think we at this stage need, as a society, for everyone to individually realize we have to step up to the plate, be serious about these social distancing recommendations about no large meetings, things like this, so that we, in fact, then protect our parents or our grandparents or our friends and family that may be, you know, cancer, chemotherapy, or heart disease. We need to make sure we're all playing our part to help the society as well.
On that note, Abigail Wysocki asked this question. Do we know if once someone has had COVID-19 and recovered, are they immune? Can they become reinfected?
That's a very good question. I think really the jury is out on that. From what we have seen from other coronaviruses, it appears that there would be some immunity afterwards. The question is how long it would last. Is it short-lived versus longer? We really aren't going to know this until we've had this play out a little bit longer and see what happens for those people who have recovered. And incidentally, I might mention, in terms of, again, looking at the glass half full in this particular pandemic situation, there are now more persons who have recovered from COVID-19 than are currently cases of COVID-19. The encouraging word out of China with the rapid fall off of number of cases, both in Hubei as well as outside Hubei province, shows that, in fact, you know, we have the mechanisms and tools that we can use and bring to bear to curb this pandemic.
Talking to Dr. Robert Kim Farley with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. When it comes to being self-quarantined as both a preventative measure and once someone shows symptoms, as a result, a lot of people are stockpiling on food and supplies. We've seen it all in the news. How contagious are grocery stores? If there's going to be a lot of people in a small store, is that something that maybe we should avoid, even if we don't have supplies stocked up?
Well, I think, again, it's important to do the normal sorts of things one would be wanting to do, washing hands frequently, not touching your mouth and eyes with your hands. If someone is ill, they shouldn't really be coming to these stores. If you see someone who is coughing, you know, ask them, be sure that they do cover their cough. And, you know, social distance yourself from anyone who's showing any signs of illness like that.
I think of like those produce shelves where everyone's kind of just grabbing an apple to see how firm it is, and then they put it back and then someone else grabs it. I think that's what people are worried about.
Yes. Well, again, I think that the virus can last on surfaces, but again, with normal washing and things like this that you would do in preparation for an apple before eating it, that should be fine.
Wondering, when it comes to a place like Southern California, specifically where we live here, a place that's so spread out and where there's not a lot of public transportation, unlike, say, New York City, we spend more times in our cars, personal cars, just one person in one car. Is that kind of something going in our favor? Does that lessen the threat of spreading?
Well, I guess it is somewhat social distancing, but yeah. I think the important thing to realize is that oftentimes maybe the most vulnerable persons, maybe the elderly, et cetera, may not have access to that. They may be using public transport. So that I think we realize that, you know, there is a need to make sure that we are using these same precautions, again, hand washing, covering cough, things like this, when we are on public conveniences, and the ability of using the sanitary wipe, for example, on the armrests or tray tables, things like this, would make sense.
One last thing really quick. We got a listener question about quarantine, and they asked, if one family member is required to self-quarantine at home, are all other members of the family required to quarantine as well?
No, it's really for the person that has had that exposure, and that's why they're being quarantined, so that they are being observed and watched and monitored. Should they become symptomatic, however, other family members that may have been in close contact with them then would have to go into a quarantine period themselves.
That's Dr. Robert Kim Farley with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. He addressed listener questions about novel coronavirus. Doctor, thank you very much for being a resource for us.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
The spread of the coronavirus is already leaving many people out of work. Events are canceled, customers are avoiding restaurants and gyms, travel has slowed to a crawl. For those, though, who are still working, the big question is, what happens if I get sick? Can I still make my rent and pay my bills? KPCC's David Wagner covers the economy. He's here now to break down your options. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, eh?
Now, people want to know, if they get sick and cannot go to work, will they still get paid?
So that really depends. If you're an employee, the answer is probably yes. But how much paid leave do you have stored up? You may be able to file for unemployment or disability. The state is encouraging workers affected by the coronavirus to do so. But can you get by on those benefits? They probably aren't going to cover your full salary. So in short, the answer here is that many workers can get paid while they're out sick, but for some, it might not be enough, and others won't get paid at all.
All right, let's start off then with who definitely will get paid, who's eligible for sick days, and how much time they'll get.
So under California law, pretty much all employees are entitled to at least 3 days of paid sick leave. That requirement is even higher under some local laws. So, for instance, here in the city of Los Angeles, employers are required to provide at least 6 days of paid sick time. Of course, employers can offer more, and many do allow their workers to accrue higher amounts of paid sick time. You should check with your own company to see how many sick days you have in the bank.
All right, so employees in California get at least 3 paid sick days, sometimes more, but will that be enough for workers who come down with coronavirus?
In many cases, no, it won't. So people who test positive for COVID-19 or who are suspected to have it, they're being asked to quarantine themselves for 2 weeks. Sebastian Sanchez is an employment attorney with Betsedic. He says many workers don't get enough paid sick time to get through that quarantine period.
It really puts a lot of workers at risk when they are unable to receive benefits that cover extensive absences that are required under a situation like this.
That's why a lot of workers might choose to just keep showing up to work, even if they're sick.
Wondering, David, though, workers, do they have any other options besides paid sick leave?
They do. There are some other options out there. So California officials have been saying that if workers fall sick or if they're exposed to the coronavirus, they can file a claim with the state's disability insurance program. That would replace some of their lost wages, but not all. It would provide about 70% of their income. Governor Gavin Newsom has also said that the state is going to waive the usual one-week waiting period before workers can start receiving those benefits. And you don't even necessarily have to get sick to qualify for help from the state. If workers get laid off or lose hours due to the coronavirus, they can also file for unemployment benefits. But that tops out at $450 per week.
Now, David, I'll bet a lot of workers out there, especially here in Los Angeles, are probably wondering, what if I'm not an employee? What if I'm an independent contractor?
The bad news is you're likely on your own. You know, if you are self-employed, if you work in the gig economy, you don't get the benefits and protections that come with traditional employment. That includes things like paid sick time and unemployment benefits. Companies like Uber have said that they will compensate drivers who test positive for COVID-19, or if they're asked by a public health authority to quarantine for 2 weeks. But Ken Jacobs with the UC Berkeley Labor Center says that policy is not sufficient because right now workers aren't getting access to testing.
We are not in a place right now where we can afford to have people wait until they have a positive diagnosis to decide to do social distancing. And that is what the companies are asking of these workers.
Of course, Uber drivers could just choose to stay home on their own, especially now that demand for rides is pretty low. But if they don't have personal savings to get through this, they could be in financial trouble.
Wondering then, what are lawmakers doing right now to respond?
House Democrats have proposed legislation that would mandate paid sick leave and family leave on a federal level, and that would be a first in the country. Senate Democrats, including California's Senator Kamala Harris, have called for the same, but, you know, we're seeing Republicans in the Senate not seeming very open to the idea, and as of now, it just doesn't look very likely to pass anytime soon. Now, at the local level, though, there's also talk at the LA City Council of imposing an eviction moratorium. This would ensure that workers who miss paychecks due to the coronavirus wouldn't end up losing their homes.
Now, what is this pandemic revealing about our workforce and actually in our ability to tackle a public health crisis such as this?
Yeah, you know, the people I interviewed for this told me that this really shows kind of how backwards our labor policies can be when it comes to public health. So on the one hand, you have these high-paid office workers who don't really interact all that much with the public. They can easily work from home, and many of them get lots of paid sick time. Then on the other hand, you have low-wage workers in restaurants, retail, and other service jobs who can't work from home. They don't have much access to paid sick time, and they're actually the ones that are more likely to spread the infection because they do interact with the public a lot more in their jobs. Studies have shown that paid sick leave policies can slow the spread of the seasonal flu, so I think what you're going to hear now is more calls to expand paid sick leave, not just for the workers themselves, but for public health as well.
That's KPCC reporter David Wagner talking about how workers can deal with the risk of getting the coronavirus. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, we know that you depend on reliable information so you can make informed decisions for yourself, your family, your community. We suspended our spring member drive to bring you uninterrupted coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, but our funding needs, well, they stay the same. They remain exactly the same. So when you give right now at kpcc.org, your donation will be matched thanks to a generous gift from Gordon and Donna Crawford. So please, please give right now at kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. Think of it as giving for the thousands of listeners who really rely on us each and every day. One more time, kpcc.org, and thanks. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. This is the message many parents got this morning from the Los Angeles Unified School District.
Effective Monday, March 16th, we will close all Los Angeles Unified Public Schools for 2 weeks while we evaluate the appropriate path forward.
That was Superintendent Austin Buettner on that voicemail. Already, many private schools in the area had closed down earlier in the week, but the move by LAUSD sends more than 500,000 kids home, creating all kinds of logistical headaches for families as they scramble to figure out childcare and how to keep kids up on their studies. Kyle Stokes has been following all of this. Kyle, welcome back.
Good to be here.
It's got to be a very difficult decision, given how large the district is. But briefly, can you give us a sense of what's going on in the room this morning as the school board weighed this decision?
Yeah, I mean, the trade-offs of this decision are too, you know, long of a list to list in this short segment. But suffice it to say that the district has been caught between a rock and a hard place on this, because this is a district in LAUSD that serves more than 4 out of 5 of the district students depend on the district for free and reduced price meals. And there was concern about what would happen if the district were to stop providing those social services in a very sudden fashion. The other issue is that state and local public health officials today have actually said that it's not necessary to close down schools unless there is an actual case within an individual school. And there are, as of this morning, no cases that are known in L.A. County that have been linked to an LAUSD school. So these are sort of the kind of prevailing thinking, but that's been changing in recent days. The union, the teachers union, put out a call yesterday for the district to cancel classes. And I think there's also been growing frustration among parents as they watch other institutions shut down, look at, you know, institutions like LAUSD and wonder, why are the schools still open?
Biggest question, Kyle, how will kids keep learning?
Yeah, this is going to be one of the largest scale experiments in distance learning ever, you know, conducted. Yeah. This is the nation's second largest school district moving to almost complete distance learning for the next 2 weeks. The district has told all of its teachers to come out with plans to figure out how to get through those next 2 weeks while delivering lessons essentially either over the internet or in packets that they were going to send home. I spoke with one teacher yesterday who said even before the closure that the district, his principal actually had told him to start sending home materials that students could complete and be ready to do that by Friday. This was easy enough for this teacher who's been all digital in his classroom for a long time anyway. And it's worth mentioning that the district does have a lot of the software infrastructure in place with this learning platform called Schoology, which is a sort of touch point for parents and students to check their grades and see assignments. That's going to be critical as the district moves forward as a way to exchange assignments. And other teachers are using other tools like Zoom video conferencing and Google Classroom. There are a lot of different tools at educators' disposal. That's the main way that it's going to continue. And the other thing that's going to be really critical here is that the district recently used emergency spending authority to buy $10 million worth of new devices that students can take home. If they don't have a device at home and need to be able to access the internet, that they'll at least, you know, potentially by the middle of next week, they'll have more, you know, access to a device in order to do so. One sort of, you know, hiccup in this, about a quarter of the district students are believed not to have internet.
Yeah.
The delivery of those lessons could be difficult because there has yet to be some sort of deal made with internet service providers to make sure those services can be provided.
What about homeless kids in LAUSD?
Well, so this might be an area where the district family resource centers might become critical. The district this morning announced that they would have plans to open up the 40 different locations where students would be able to go and get a hot meal and get childcare if necessary. It should be noted that there's going to be coronavirus testing at these facilities, and that the facilities are going to be staffed by Red Cross volunteers, by some district staffers, and as well as by some county employees. And they will be screening people for coronavirus symptoms. Essentially, if they have a fever, they might not be allowed in. But this is the way that the district is sort of squaring that circle that I mentioned earlier. How do you keep providing social services while the schools themselves are closed?
We've been talking about kids, though. What about teachers and staff? How will they be taken care of during this time?
Yeah, I mean, they are going to continue to be paid. The district has said even if they're not providing direct services to students, all 75,000 employees in LAUSD will continue to receive paychecks. And as I mentioned, the teachers who are working in those service centers are going to receive extra pay for doing that.
One more thing, Kyle. We know school funding is reliant on attendance. Is the state waiving this somehow so that school districts aren't penalized for closing down?
Well, Austin Buettner, the superintendent, said earlier today that the economics of this, we're just going to sort of hope that this works out. This is a decision that's made for health and safety reasons. But yeah, I mean, this is absolutely a pressure point. The district has asked in the past for the state to waive its current requirement that schools be paid based on the number of actual students who show up. The way that virtual schools in California, interestingly, are paid and compensated in terms of state funding is based on an entirely different system. And so I think that there's been some legalistic type questions of whether or not schools are going to be able to have access to this emergency ADA funding, is what it's called. Yeah. So the district is certainly advocating at the state level to try and get this sorted out.
KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks.
You're welcome.
Universities and colleges around Southern California have also been canceling classes or moving them online, also postponing events and generally disrupting students' lives. Here are stories from USC, UCLA, Pomona, and Loyola Marymount University. Students talking about how they've been impacted by their respective schools' new policies in light of the coronavirus.
My name is Noelle Trost. I'm a freshman at USC, and a lot of people, since the classes have moved to online, they don't really see a purpose in being here, so they've left, and campus is much more empty, and services are still going on, but like I noticed today in my dining hall, we're not allowed to get the food ourselves. We have to let someone like hand the food to us, and oh, it was really empty. Same with the libraries, too. It's much more empty.
My name is Luca Canuccio. I'm a first year at Loyola Marymount University. I do track, and we were scheduled to have a meet on Saturday previously, and then yesterday we learned that it was canceled. We re-entered into another invitational, which was happening on the same day, and that meet was going to occur with no spectators, but that meet was canceled, and then shortly after that, the NCAA canceled all spring sports for the rest of the season. It's really disappointing.
My name's Elise Boretz. I'm a grad student and teaching assistant at UCLA. At 3:30 on Tuesday afternoon, they said, first thing in the morning, you need to switch to online lectures, and we won't be holding any classes on campus. So it was a big turnaround, a real 180 for everyone to completely change how they were conducting classes and attending classes. And it does change things. I mean, I had my classes this morning, and it's just hard to sit at your own desk chair and give a lecture to silence.
My name is Ash Maria. I'm a sophomore at Pomona College. Right now, what's on my mind is just like making sure I can get housing from the school. Pomona sent out a petition for students to fill out explaining why you should have housing until the end of the semester on campus. I'm from Seattle, like Kenmore, Washington, which is like right next to Kirkland, Washington, where like 15 people died. So it's like really bad idea for me to go home. And also like my mental health isn't super good when I'm home. It's really important for me to be with people who I feel supported by and have that community with, and I wouldn't have that back in Kenmore.
My name is Lindsay Mulcahy, first year master's student at USC. I'm doing a dual degree in heritage conservation and urban planning. I was planning on being at a conference next week on a panel, which I will obviously not be doing that. It was for the National Council for Public History. It was something that I had applied for, had gotten funding for, had been waiting for the last couple months, was really looking forward to meeting all of these other professionals, and so that was a big bummer.
Those were the voices of students from area colleges talking about how the virus that causes COVID-19 is affecting their lives. Take Two's Ari Saperstein produced that segment. All right, now we paused our spring member drive so we could bring you uninterrupted coverage of the pandemic, but we cannot pause the need for your support, your member support, which really remains our most vital source of funding. So please donate right now at kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org for the fact-based news about coronavirus. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. This is usually the time of the show when we talk about the events happening in our area, but due to the escalating situation around COVID-19, we're offering a special edition of Weekend Preview. You can call it the Cabin Fever Edition. But maintaining some calm and keeping things normal, Leo Duran remains our guide. Hey, Leo.
Hey. Yeah, that's my calm voice.
Yeah, that's a creepy voice.
But yeah, precautions for COVID-19 have shuttered many public events throughout Southern California and the world. We do have a list up, but it's ever-changing. Things might stop. Plus, the rain doesn't help matters. But there are plenty of things that people can still do to relax a bit and be entertained, even social.
Okay, yeah, and that's right, because what if some people had to self-quarantine for a couple of weeks?
Exactly. I mean, it may sound like I go out a lot by mentioning these events, but I do love staying inside for days on end. I mean, I am Leo has a cat, not Leo has FOMO. Yeah. So I'm a bit of an expert here at staying on the couch with my animal.
All right, first, there's the obvious, television. So what do you recommend there?
So for that, I got some advice from TV expert extraordinaire Mark Jordan Ligon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, his recommendation on what to stream kind of leans into what we're dealing with.
For somewhat escapism, I would highly recommend The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Which is that Netflix series comedy starring Ellie Kemper as Kimmy Schmidt, who was kidnapped and spent years sequestered away from society.
She's so full of hope and optimism. I think that would be a very good show to binge on. Also, for that reason, there is life after being in a bunker.
Which is very true. So I'll probably revisit the show myself because I do want something light and hopeful.
And that's actually a great way to start. But he also has a darker suggestion.
Yeah, sort of darker. It's a series on Showtime starring Jim Carrey. It's called Kidding with co-executive producer Michel Gondry, who they last worked together on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Jim Carrey plays kind of a Mr. Rogers character, a guy named Mr. Pickles, who has been the beloved star of a children's show for over 30 years, but he's having a breakdown now.
And Mark says it's a sweet mix of folksiness with a bit of darkness to it, which kind of describes our times.
Now, despite the fact that you're in your 40s, Leo, you're big into video games, and you got some advice on which games are good to play online.
Yeah, this first one is for all ages, and it's on nearly any platform. It's Minecraft. Mm. For those not familiar with it, I like to call it if Legos were in a video game. It's basically open world, meaning you can do anything and build anything. There is no ultimate goal. Here's Nicole Carpenter from the video game website Polygon.
You can build anything. I have a friend who was talking about a machine that harvested chickens and turned them into fried chicken for the colony that they had started. You can do anything. It's ridiculous.
And my friend's little kids play it. They basically build castles all the time and like go into mines. So if you're feeling cooped up, this is a great way to create and explore your own world.
My granddaughters play it, Leo. And apparently llamas are very valuable in Minecraft. That's what they say. Now, there's also another game just like that that's coming out soon.
Yeah, this one I'm personally excited about. It's the new version of Animal Crossing. It'll be released for the Nintendo Switch next week Friday, so you do have a few days to wait. But multiple people I talked to said it'll be a great game for these troubling times. Here's Ashley Esqueda from CNET.
You get to set up your own deserted island, and then your friends who also have the game and Nintendo Switch can come visit your island. So you can connect with people without actually being in their vicinity, which is key during a self-quarantine phase.
It's a very, very wholesome game. I've played past versions a lot. Basically, all you do is build your house and give gifts to your animal neighbors. That's it. You also do have a home loan, but you pay it off. Oh. There is no interest in it, however.
Good. It is highly addictive. So if you have to work from home, you got to be really careful about getting into Animal Crossing because it may impact your workload.
Now, okay, what though if it gets pretty lonely streaming all those programs, playing all those games at home by yourself alone? I mean, what can you do?
Well, it is 2020. There's actually a way around that because back in my day, my friends and I would actually video conference call, toggle up a movie together and hit play at the same time. That is old school. There's actually two solutions I found for this. The first is this great app for your computer. It's called Netflix Party. Obviously, it's for Netflix, and what you can do is start a movie or show on the streaming service. Then you create a link to send to your friends anywhere. They log in, and then they can watch what you're watching at the exact same time. So there's no, you know, few seconds difference. Plus, there's a chat window, so you can talk during the viewing. Obviously, by the name, it only works for Netflix. It's also only for your computers, so not for when you stream Netflix on TVs.
And then there's another way to connect. What is that?
Polygon's Nicole Carpenter suggested this one to me. It's called Discord. So it's an app similar to Skype and FaceTime. It's basically a free chat service created specifically for gamers, but you don't actually have to be a gamer to use it. It's good to start video and conference calls with friends.
Discord is so helpful through all of this because some of me and my friends just play whatever game we're playing and hop in a Discord channel and chat with each other regardless of the game we're playing.
She even uses it to start a movie or a game on her end, then streams it to her friends in a chat so they can watch it all at the same time.
Wow. Okay. Now, we're trying to avoid cabin fever, Leo, but some of us will have kids at home with us. Too much screen time might get a little old really fast. So what advice do you have there?
Yeah. So I actually thought, who better to give advice on how to educate and entertain kids at home than someone who homeschools? So I talked with Jennifer Daugherty, a board member at River Oaks Academy. That's a charter school with campuses in Westlake Village and Oxnard. And one activity she suggested starts with a simple deck of cards.
Pick two cards and ask your kid to multiply it, get the answer, and if they win, they keep the cards, and if they don't, you get to keep the cards.
So like a kid's version of blackjack? But I will say, even though avoiding screen time is a good idea, she actually said she got this one idea and a bunch more from the wealth of resources that are available on YouTube. And it's not just educational games. There are activities and ideas on how to keep kids moving indoors too.
Just search for yoga or kids workouts. You can't believe how many other families where their kids show other kids how to work out. Yoga instructors that lead classes strictly for kids based on certain age groups.
All right. Finally, you had one last suggestion on what to do with kids inside, indoors, that keeps them active.
Yeah, two words, pillow forts. Now, there is no such thing as a pillow fort expert in America. I did search for this, but there are architects who happen to love pillow forts, like Ben Pell, who runs a firm, Pell Overton, in New York City. And he says, start with the foundation.
You want to make sure you use big pillows because they kind of help by not only giving the pillow fort a little bit more structure, but they also lift the blanket or whatever you're using, the sheet, to kind of create the roof.
Then once that roof is up, it's a matter of securing the part that's draped over the pillows lying on the floor.
You know, some books or maybe even an animal if you've got a dog or a really heavy cat who likes to be sedentary and sit in place while your kids run in and out of the fort. So that works pretty well.
So it is up to you to decide on how long that pillow fort stays up. But another architect I talked to asked his epidemiologist friends whether there's any good reason not to build a pillow fort during these times. He was told, no, build that fort.
Gotta be careful, though. If it's a load-bearing pillow, then, you know, the whole thing will come down.
I know, but At least if it comes crashing down on you, it's very cushiony. It's cuddly.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. If you have ideas on how to beat cabin fever for yourself, your family, your kids, let us know. Tweet us at Take Two.
Or you can also tweet me too, at Leo Has a Cat. Don't know if my cat will be good at holding down a pillow fort roof, though.
That's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, A.
All right, you know us here at KPCC. We are committed to bringing you fact-based, reliable information about coronavirus. We suspended our member drive this week, but we still need your support. We're still counting on the spring drive to fund the news that you're relying on coronavirus. So please give right now at kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. And when you do, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by Gordon and Donna Crawford. That's kpcc.org. All right, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.